tonight on Arena. Arlene Hunt on her new thriller While She Sleeps and Beast, Official Competition and Her Way are the films for review. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. In our Thursday night film reviews, to South Africa, where a family must survive being hunted by the king of the jungle, then to Spain, where three egomaniacs are commissioned by a millionaire to make a movie together, and to France, where a hard-working mother strives to provide a future for her teenage son. In the Spanish comedy Official Competition, a millionaire decides on his 80th birthday that he needs something more memorable than business success to guarantee his legacy. He decides to produce a film after securing the rights to a Nobel Prize winning novel. Official Competition stars Penelope Cruz, Antonio Banderas and Oscar Martinez. In her way, Marie, an independent sex worker and activist, dreams of a bright future for her son. She decides to enroll him in one of the best cookery schools in France. And in Beast, a father and his two teenage daughters find themselves hunted by a massive rogue lion. Joining me are Deirdre Malumbi and Chris Wasser, who have been to the cinema for us. We start with Beast, which stars Idris Elba, who goes to South Africa with his teenage daughters to heal their relationship after the death of their mother. Deirdre, can you tell us a little more about why the Samuel family are in South Africa on this apparent dream holiday?
Yeah, so this film is headlined by Idris Elba, who people will know very well at this stage, particularly for starring in the TV series The Wire and Luther. And his character, Dr. Nate Samuels, he would have divorced from his two teenage daughters' mother just shortly before she contracted cancer and died. So obviously there's a lot of kind of emotions going on here. And I suppose the whole idea of them going to visit this game reserve in South Africa is in an attempt to become more of a family again. While they're over there, they're staying with Nate's old friend, Martin, who is played by Charlotte Copley, who is a biologist and rumoured anti-poacher, and he works at this game reserve. But their dream trip away turns into an absolute nightmare when they see a local village has been slaughtered by a lion. And guess what? The lion is now after them.
OK, well, let's listen to a clip. Here, Dr. Nate Samuels and his daughters are introduced to the local lion pride. The male quickly lets them know who's boss. We hear Idris Elba, Nate Charlotte Copley. Idris Elba is Nate. Charlotte Copley is Martin. Leah Jeffries as Nora. Iyana Halley as Meredith. And Tapilo Segbogoji as Camo.
That up there is the Nandi Pride.
Yep.
It's named after that magnificent matriarch in the middle there.
Wow. Yep, and the males are Kuda and his brother Kawe.
Kawe?
Kawe.
And are we safe right here?
Oh, you're safe. They just finished off last night's kill.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
That is insane. You go clean
up. Okay, it's all right, you're okay. He's just letting you know that he's there. See, the way it works with lions is the females do the hunting, the males protect the pride.
Well, protect them from what?
Usually from other lions. Any lion from outside the family comes into their territory, Kuda and Kawe will leap onto it, start ripping it apart limb from limb, or die trying. It's the law of the jungle.
So, Chris, that lion we heard there, is that the one who causes all the trouble?
That's not the one who causes all the trouble.
He seemed fine.
Yeah, he's tame. You know, he's kind of, he's sort of a Simba sort of lion. But we're getting the Scar lion, basically, that goes up against Idris Elba later on.
Okay, and what has the rogue lion got motivation and reason?
He does. So at the beginning of the film, we see that a group of poachers have come in on this lion and its pride, and pretty much taken out the pride. And the lion is obviously angry, upset, frustrated, and decides to take them down one by one as though it's a sort of a Batman lion in a way. Some of the scenes here are quite unbelievable, but the idea that a lion might go rogue and just take down anything in its path on two legs, I mean, that's sort of believable. We are dealing with, you know, very, you know, gigantic, vicious animals here.
Is this gory, the taking down? What does that mean?
Actually, an awful lot of it happens in the shadows. There is a little, you know, there's just, for a while, there's a touch of Jaws about it in terms of let's not show the viewers the big bad. Let's kind of, you know, tease it up until Idris Elba's Nate character, you know, is stalked by it and trapped. Because the setup here actually works quite well, that, you know, Nate and his family, they are out on this reserve. They've been granted, you know, access to areas that other, you know, tourists wouldn't be, because Martin is the game reserve manager. And it's only when they stumble across this village and see, as Deirdre said, that, you know, almost an entire village has been taken out, that they run but realize they've actually wandered into a trap of sorts set by the lion. And a lot of the film then actually takes place inside of a car, and you're thinking to yourself, how can you, you know, have maybe 20, how can you even have 10 minutes of tension with, you know, four characters trapped in a car, or maybe, you know, three at times trapped in a car and a lion outside? An awful lot, as it turns out, because the filmmaker here, Baltasar Kormákur, he is used to making these sort of, you know, very, very tense and dramatic survival thrillers. We had, you know, he's done Everest, which is obviously set on Everest, and he did Adrift, which was set at sea, and they both kind of, you know, put very ordinary characters with ordinary real life problems into these extraordinary situations, and they're handled very well, as this one is.
So Deirdre, Chris is talking about being trapped in a car there, so you've got the lion and you've got a lot of acting going on in the car. How does the lion look, first of all? Is he a real lion, or is he a CGI lion?
So all of the lions in this movie actually are CGI. You do get some shots when they're kind of driving around in the reserve. You do get some shots of actual animals from a distance. But I suppose, you know, as the world kind of becomes more, you know, environmentally cautious and everything around, you know, the protection of animals, I think we're probably going to see more and more CGI animals. Gone are the days of the 90s where it's, you know, kind of talking animals and stuff like that. I think we're going to be seeing a lot less of that now. But for my money, I actually thought that the CGI line looked really well. You know, it's really important that there's, you know, a believable texture to it, that the light reflects off the fur and everything quite well. And I thought that it was done very well in this film. Whereas when it's not done well, it can kind of take you out of it a bit. Now, mind you, when the humans are interacting physically with the lion, and there are a couple of like quite, you know, big moments with that, it can look a little less realistic, unfortunately. But I'll also add to Chris's point there, what he was saying about the direction. I also have to say a lot of the credit, I think, goes to the cinematography in this. It utilizes a lot of these really long tracking shots, which I think add a lot to the intensity, to the sense of suspense, to the action. And this director of photography here is a man named Philippe Roselot, who's actually an Oscar and a BAFTA winner. And you can absolutely see that he's excellent at his craft. He's worked with Neil Jordan in the past. He's done Interview with the Vampire, The Miracle. He did the Sherlock Holmes 2 movies with Robert Downey Jr. He did the first two Fantastic Beasts movies. So he's got like a really great repertoire behind him, and he does really
and
well
South
in this
Africa
too.
Looks well.
It looks absolutely stunning, actually.
Chris, then Idris Elba is obviously it's a star vehicle for him. Would that be fair to say?
Oh, you're
quite a fan of his work, which is quite varied.
I am, yeah. I mean, he's had the dream TV role. He's had two of them, with The Wire and with Luther. I sometimes get the feeling that casting agents, not that they're not sure what to do with Idris Elba, but sometimes he ends up in the wrong film. But despite ending up in some very, you know, average action films like, you know, The Suicide Squad or Bastille Day or Hobbs and Shaw, all of which had their high points, but, you know, a few more low points. Even when the film is not that interesting, usually Idris Elba is the most interesting thing about it, you know, because he is quite handy with drama and he's very cozy with action. So you do have this, you know, an in Beast, you know, there is an action man waiting to break out here, and one that, you know, should have been given a little bit more reverent wit to work with. Because the whole time I was watching this film, I was thinking, look, as Dee said, this looks terrific. The tracking shots work very well. Charlton Copley, as, you know, the sort of guy who, basically, Charlotte Copley is playing the sort of guy, if you ended up on Trouble in Safari, you'd want him there. And he plays that character effectively. And, you know, the supporting cast were fine. The action, you know, it was never boring, basically. One thing it is missing is a sense of humor. And I was thinking the whole time, this is Idris Elba. This is the kind of guy who has, you know, I mean, the most famous scene he had memorably in Hobbs and Shaw was when he came out and referred to himself as this genetically enhanced cyberbody, as the Black Superman. And because it's Idris Elba, you can take lines like that and they're delivered so well. This film just could have done with a bit more kind of, you know, a little bit more self-awareness. We are very much aware of the fact that it's so ridiculous that a man going up against a lion is, you know, and surviving. You know, it just needs a bit. It needs a bit more humor.
Now, this might work against your theory there that Martin is the guy you want on safari with you, because here Nate, played by Idris Elba, radios Martin, Charlotte Copley, to find out where he is so he can come and get him. Martin tells him that he can't come because he's cornered by a lion.
So listen, I'm going to try and come to you, okay?
Is he okay?
Do you understand that, Martin? I'm going to try and come to you.
Negative, Nate. I'm not alone.
What?
He's staring right at me.
The lion is staring right at you?
Oh, my God.
Why would he do that?
We have to go get him.
Son of a bitch. Is staring right at me.
That we have to go and get him now.
That doesn't sound right, man. What's going on? That doesn't sound natural.
If I didn't know any better, I'd say I'm the bait.
We gotta come get you, man. If you stay by there, you're gonna die.
That sounds like a very, very tense scene.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Do we have sympathy for the lion?
No, not really, I suppose. I mean, to be honest, like, he's almost like cartoonishly big and villainous and stuff like that. And I suppose you're never really given a point at which to relate to him. I think that another thing that maybe this film like fell a bit short of was it's very clearly got this anti-poaching message running through it. I would have liked to see a little bit more of it eventually emerges, and it's kind of like rumoured throughout the film, that Charlotte Copley's character Martin is what you call an anti-poacher, and namely he is actually hunting the poachers. And I would have liked to see a little bit more of that, of his character. But at that, he gives a very good performance. I think that both him and Idris Elba are very kind of naturally charismatic and talented actors. And I have to also give a lot of credit to Iyanna Halley and Leah Sava Jeffries in this, because it's essentially a four-hander between those four actors. And obviously Charlotte Copley and Idris Elba have, like, you know, many, many credits behind them. So it wasn't kind of an easy job. And I think they also had a tough time in that they are playing the two teenage daughters. And those are two performances that could so easily have collapsed into these hysterical, annoying, like slightly bratty children. And there are a couple of moments where you're like, oh, why do they have to make these stupid decisions? And why can't they just listen to their father? But at that, they both gave very kind of emotional, I thought, and moving performances, and very kind of realistic. They definitely seemed terrified, and I felt a bit scared along with them.
Well, it sounds like a very good summer thriller. Stars out of five from you, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a classic, you know, it's definitely not a blockbuster classic in the making. I think, as I said, Idris Elba saves the day. It's a committed performance. It looks great. You know, I was rooting for it. I just, again, I think it just sort of had a bit more of a sense of humor, and it just, yeah, there was it starts an awful lot of stories that it then refuses to finish. So look, best thing about it, Kate, it's done and dusted in 90 minutes. Three stars.
And from you, Deirdre?
Yeah, I definitely found it an entertaining cinema outing. I don't think it's going to be, you know, breaking any walls anytime soon. And I mean, the summer 2022 blockbuster season, I suppose, is just coming to an end at this point, having its last gasp for air. But it's a bit of popcorn entertainment. So it's 3 stars for me.
Three out of five from both of you. Next up, Official Competition, a satire on the movie business. Penelope Cruz is a revered arthouse film director, and Antonia Banderas and Oscar Martinez play the two rival leads in the film she has agreed to make for an 80-year-old millionaire who wants this to be the project to ensure his name lives on long after he's gone. So, Chris, Official Competition, it's a film based on a Nobel, the film they're making is based on a Nobel Prize winning novel. So how does this come to the screen?
Well, Humberto, who, as you said, he's this he's wealthy industrialist, and he's thinking to himself, oh, am I even going to be remembered after I'm gone? He's having a bit of a late life crisis on his 80th birthday. So for reasons that are probably, you know, that he can understand, I'll produce this film. It doesn't matter what that film is. I don't even need to read the book that film is going to be based on. I just want my name up there in lights, and I want to give something, you know, to the art world. And he finds in Penelope Cruz's Lolo Cuevas a sort of a Stanley Kubrick director. Oh, actually, I only say Stanley Kubrick because it is this art house director that wants to make a film based on a very successful novel, but wants to do things her own way. And he thinks that, you know, Umberto, that's fine because I haven't read the book, just do what you want. And this story of, you know, it's called Rivalry. I'd actually love to read it, or I'd actually, if it was a real story, I would definitely read it, or I would definitely watch it on the screen. It's about warring siblings. One of them ends up in prison following the tragic death of their parents. And this director, played by Cruz, she thinks to herself, right, I need to find two very intense Spanish actors to play these roles. But she decides to kind of stir the pot a little bit, and on one side hires this, you know, vacuous, you know, box office concrete movie star portrayed by Antonio Banderas. His name is Felix. And then in the other, you have this snobbish, snooty, you know, indie darling played by Oscar Martinez. His name is Ivan, and basically puts them in a room together, and all hell breaks loose.
So Ivan, the Oscar Martinez character, he's not a wealthy man. He teaches drama to a loving group of students. His wife is a serious children's book writer, whereas the Antonio Banderas Felix character arrives with a new woman in a fast car to all of the rehearsals. Tell us a little bit about how the dynamic develops.
Oh, it absolutely works like so well, and it's so funny because these are three big personalities between Ivan, Felix and Lola, and they cannot just stop butting heads. It's really quite interesting. Penelope Cruz is Lola, who's got this, you know, eccentric personality and this very specific mode of working. Ultimately, she does just want to get the best out of her cast. So I suppose you feel a bit kind of, you know, you can empathise with that, her work as a director, but it also drives her two actors to the point of insanity. And the funny thing about it is that neither of these characters are particularly likable. They're both incredibly obnoxious, actually. There's one scene in which Felix gets this tiny cut on his face and he's berating Ivan for ruining his work tool. And then there's another point where Ivan proves himself just as haughty. He tells Felix about this technique where he calls out his own name while his eyes are shut to get into the zone. And in another funny moment later on, you see Felix practicing the same technique to himself. But Ivan even goes as far as at one point practicing his Oscar rejection speech in the mirror so that he would receive the Oscar and then reject it for all of these, like,
because he's too high-minded.
Exactly.
Is it a bit easy fodder picking on actors and the method, you know, the Stanislavski method on in Ivan's case, and
sure,
then Felix superficiality?
You might think that, but every now and then we need a film like this, I think. I didn't think we were going to, I thought what we were going to see was, because we move into this workshop, we move into this rehearsal place where Lola has basically rented out an empty theatre space for a week or two so that they can rehearse. And it turns out that that's the entire film, the workshop. You know, I thought this was actually going to be set in a film, on a film set, but that works brilliantly, because what we then get is, you know, this wonderful exploration of the different working methods that the two actors bring to the table. One of them doesn't really care for the idea of getting into character. It's just learn the lines, recite the lines, pick up the paycheck.
Whereas
Ivan wants to feel, you know, wants to create a past for his character, one that isn't on the page. And
Lola goes to all lengths to try and, you know, instill fear in the Antonio Banderas character.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Sometimes she puts their lives at risk. You know, she brings in this boulder that's held up by a crane and has them recite their lines underneath it so that they can feel the weight, they can feel the pressure on their, you know, on their characters. But as you say, it might seem like, you know, low hanging fruit. But as I said, I think sometimes we need this, because I looked at it as like this slippery kind of send up of the industry and of how actors, you know, sometimes like to take everything that they're doing far too seriously. I mean, you know, Felix, as I said, he is a bit of a vacuous movie star, but he does take himself and, you know, his face, his working tool, as he said, you know, very seriously. And I just think I thought it played out brilliantly as this kind of, you know, absurd satire on, you know, what it's like, you know, and what it's like to play pretend for a living, basically.
You, Deirdre, and stars out of five?
I would give this 3.5 out of 5 stars. I thought that visually it was really compelling. I think that comedies can have a tough time, particularly when they're in a foreign language, but because this film is so visually orientated, it really worked. I thought it was a cheeky ode to cinema. I liked the way it kind of made fun of these industry types and method acting scenarios. I did find the pacing a little tedious at times, but I appreciated its quirks. works, and it's a very cheeky sense of humour.
Okay, 3.5 from Deirdre. From you, Chris?
I thought it was a terrific three-hander. Again, I think films about filmmaking are always worth a punt, but films about the sheer ridiculousness of the industry and the sheer ridiculousness of, as I said, playing pretend for a living are even better, and this is probably at the top of the pile. So 4 out of 5.
So 4 out of 5 and 3.5 out of 5 for official competition. Finally, fans of Call My Agent, the hit Netflix show, will recognise the lead actor in the French film Her Way. In that series, Laurie Calme plays Naomi, the secretary and love interest of Matthias, the boss of a glamorous casting agency in Paris. Here in Her Way, she is Marie, a sex worker in Strasbourg, who is having problems with her teenage son. Her Way is a debut feature film from director Cécile Durcroc. Deirdre, this film is very much about a mother and son, mm-hmm. even though her profession is a sex worker.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, that storyline with her son, what it kind of goes into is that he's expelled from this state-funded training course, and she becomes determined not just to continue his education, you know, that whole idea of she doesn't want him to end up down a similar path to her, but to enroll him in one of the best cooking schools in France. So, I mean, the title of the film, I think, is very interesting because it's actually Une Femme du Monde, which actually literally translates as a woman of the world. But the fact that they chose this title of Her Way, I think, is very much intentional. The phrase "it's her way" or "the highway" comes to mind because Marie isn't just a character who is kind of one mind. She's extremely, extremely pushy. And the thing is that she's overly so. And in a way, she kind of over pushes her son. She wants him to go to the school. He doesn't fully act like he's actually that particularly interested in it. He certainly has, this desire for cooking and stuff. But she's the one that kind of gets him all worked up about getting into this cooking school and everything. So I thought that their relationship, there was a lot of heart to it. And I thought it was very realistic in some ways. I mean, the boy is so bratty, he won't even get a job to help his mom out. And I was like, I may have seen this at home before.
And now, this wouldn't be the first French film, or the first film indeed, but the French make a lot of films about prostitution and sex workers. Is there anything new in this in terms of the lifestyle choice she's made?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, it's not even the first film, you know, based on this story. And what I mean by that is actually Cécile Ducroc has essentially built upon a film that she made nearly a decade ago here. She made a short film called Back Alley, which also starred Laurie Calame. And it explored maybe one of the subplots that we see inside here, but what Cécile has done with Her Way is build an entire world. In terms of doing something new with the themes and the ideas here, I quite like the fact that, yes, this is a film that is as much about the sex work industry as it is about a mother and her son, but it always prioritizes the story and the character, and it knows that, look, we're here for, again, this is actually the second 90 minute film on our list tonight. There are avenues it could have gone down. Marie is involved in various movements, and she's involved in marches for, you know, fairer and safer working environments for herself and others. We kind of then get into, as she realizes then that she needs to make more money, she crosses the border and gets a full-time job at this sleazy club run by this sleazy owner. And we see then that she's sort of kicking against all of her ideals, all of her beliefs, so that she can raise, you know, money for Adrian's college fees. So that idea that, you know, she can just not toss away, but just turn the other cheek if it involves her son. That you could have gone down that route, but it always sticks at this main idea of this mother struggling to kind of, you know, secure a safe future for her son. And I like that. I like that it puts story and character first.
Yes, Deirdre, she did seem to be critical of some sex workers mm-hmm. who were working out of a van, and they looked maybe that they were foreign nationals.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean that, for me anyway, I found that kind of one of the more shocking moments of the movie. She basically, she sees these black prostitutes, and she's talking to her friend basically. And this friend of hers is in the same kind of union as she is, but she's criticizing these women. She's saying that they lower the prices for everyone else, that they depreciate the cost of sex workers who are in unions, and that they don't stand by other prostitutes, which actually in a scene later on in the film, she ends up being proven wrong about. I suppose for me personally, I would have liked to see, and maybe it is more of a, you know, French cinema thing, but I thought that there would have been a bit more politics about, about prostitution in this movie. And I found that the film like was kind of focusing more on the personal aspect of it, even though we do see her protest with fellow prostitutes and act very proud about it. And I'm thinking of this particularly when it comes to her getting a job at a strip joint later on in the film so that she can raise these funds so her son can go to this, you know, this kind of well-to-do school. There's kind of this montage where she works with all her with all these clients, but it never gets particularly kind of depressing or hard-hitting. And none of the characters in this film as well are particularly villainous. It just feels a bit like everybody is just kind of getting on with the cards that they've been dealt. And I just would have liked to see maybe something a bit more challenging in this movie.
Okay, so stars out of five for Her Way.
I thought it was a fine movie. It's definitely a solid feature debut. Laura Calami, I think, carries it a lot. It wasn't particularly interesting for me, but I still thought it was a well-made movie. So it's 3 stars for me.
From you, Chris?
I would say actually first that it's a 3-star film, but Laura Calami makes it a 4-star film because her turn here is the unique selling point. I thought she was quite funny at times. She's quite moving. And to see her, you know, grow more exasperated by the minute, particularly because of the fact that sometimes Adrian is so frustrating. He just doesn't want to help whatsoever. You know, her patience is put to the test, but her love remains unconditional. And again, as I said, that's the most interesting part of it. So I'm going to go with 4.
Okay, so 4 out of 5 and 3 out of 5 for Her Way. And Beast is on general release. Official Competition and Her Way is in select cinemas. Deirdre and Chris, thank you very much. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. Arlene Hunt is a regular contributor to Arena, but she is also, more importantly, a unique voice in Irish crime fiction. Her atmospheric novels captured the world of Dublin and beyond. Her first novel was Vicious Circle, and since then she has written a total of 12 books, including her latest, While She Sleeps, a fast-paced crime thriller. The woman of the title who sleeps is Jodie Kavanagh, a seemingly angelic presence in the world, but who must have upset somebody as she is now lying in a coma after being viciously attacked. And Arlene Hunt joins me now. You're very welcome, Arlene.
Thank you.
Set the scene for us. Who is Jodie Kavanagh and how did she find herself half dead on her own floor?
And Jodie Kavanagh is a very young, very attractive, just recently separated young woman. She is works in interior designs. She's quite well known. She'd been on this television show. It was part of this television show called All Buildings Great and Small. So she lives in Kilmainham. She has almost everything going for her. Everyone loves her. She's, you know, her workmates love her. Her friends love her. She's quite close to her family. And apart from obviously separating from her husband, Simon, everything in her world seems to be perfect. But clearly something isn't, because at the very start of this book, she's found with this very serious head injury on the floor of her home in Kilmainham. And this is where we have to find out what exactly happened in this poor woman's life that resulted in this.
Now, I won't call them the suspects, but she has an ex-husband, Simon Allbridge, and he's, well, we think he's okay, we're not too sure, and then but a particularly nasty brother-in-law.
Yeah, she has her sister. She has, as the book goes on, she has a convoluted family. For many years, she was estranged from her mother. Her sister is estranged from her mother. And her sister, when she was much, much younger, had run away from home and ended up marrying this man who is basically part of a very obscure cult. And, you know, when she married this man, that was it for her mother. Like, she didn't want to be involved in it at all. And Jodie, with the best will in the world, you know, she's trying to help her sister in many ways, like giving her money here and there and trying to give her stuff for her children. And but it's clear that she doesn't particularly like Malcolm, who's the husband. And Simon, her ex-husband, didn't like him at all. And most other people seem to hold him in dim view. But, you know, her familial problems are complicated. And it's only as the detectives start to investigate what looks to the outside to be a perfect life and a perfectly wonderful life, the cracks very soon appear.
Right. As in any great murder mystery, there has to be detectives. And of course, we want to be rooting for the detective to find out along with us. So describe for us the guy who's called the Fossil. This is Elliot Ryan.
God bless him. He doesn't really deserve the title, but he gets called the Fossil all the way through the book because he is very old school. He's very set in his ways. He is a complicated man.
He's a bit banjaxed as well.
He's a bit banjaxed. Yeah, he's come previous to the book starting, the backstory is he's just come from a very stupid and terrible accident that he's had in his home. And so he was off work and he had really bad, he has in the book, he's got terrible bad back problems and he has to wear a kind of a corset as he's going around, which at one point he says it does flatter the shape. But he's, he works in he doesn't work in homicide. He works in, you know, theft, basically. That's his, the whole thing is theft. And he's back on the force. His own boss has reservations about him being back because he thinks he's back too early. He doesn't really understand why he's back. His own daughter, Shona, doesn't understand why he's back. Nobody understands. He didn't need to come back so soon, but he's back in work. And we find out fairly soon that he's back in work for other reasons other than just work. And like I say, he keeps his cards very close to his chest. But then, on his first day back in work, he is horrified to find out that he has a new sergeant working underneath him. And
oh, go on and tell us who the sergeant is. And Nola Kane is her
sergeant
name.
Sergeant Nola Kane is her name. And Sergeant Nola Kane has come from homicide. Well, I won't say she was demoted, but she was definitely moved sideways and her nose is a little bit out of joint.
Yeah, because she's made every mistake you shouldn't make.
She's young and yeah. She's a hothead. I mean, she's very full on. But as you say, she's made a lot of mistakes. She hasn't always carried herself with the deportment that maybe she should be carrying herself with. She hasn't always made the right choices in her life thus far. But one of her choices was certainly not to be bumped from homicide, which is the, you know, the holy grail of detectives, into what she considers to be, you know, a serious step down. Because when she goes over into thefts, before this case comes up, they're basically looking into bicycle thefts in Dublin. And, you know, Elliot takes this very seriously, you know, that he tells, you know, he's lecturing at one point going, you know, there's more than 5,000 bikes a year being stolen in the city. Like, that's an enormous crime. And to Nola, that's like, really? Bikes? That's what we're doing? So their initial, you know, their setup is fraught with problems because he doesn't get him or he doesn't get her and she definitely doesn't get him. So she's stuck with the fossil.
Just the perfect combination of a bit of tension between your two detectives. Now, Elliot Ryan's character was your way into the book, I think. I think when you were in here with your previous novel, you were working away on a novel that hasn't quite come to fruition yet.
That's right. I was in here about No Escape and I was about two-thirds, three-quarters of the way through a novel that I was working on and I was working away, I was writing, I was adding more words, more pages, more paragraphs. It just kept going on and on and on and on and on. You know the way they see the light at the end of the tunnel? There was no light at the end of this tunnel. It just kept going. And, you know, God bless my editor. She's such a wonderful person. Kira, she kept saying to her, like, and what is this book about? And I'd say, well, Kira, and I'd give her, you know, everything in the kitchen sink about what it was about. But there was no central theme. And so I just kept working. And then this COVID happened. That's basically what happened. COVID happened. And COVID, initially, we did everything like everybody else. You know, we did the queues, washing our hands, spraying things and everything else. But I didn't really think that much about it. I just kept working. And then COVID hit our family very hard. It took away our cousin Adrian first. And then it hit my father-in-law, who he would have been the patriarch of our family, the head of our family. And it hit him. And even though he fought it with his customary braveness, he succumbed and that was it. We lost him. And that was in March 2021. And I went back to work and just lost the interest in that book. I just didn't, for whatever reason, and I'm not even sure exactly what it was. I think I was oscillating between being angry and sad and angry and sad, and as people do, because there's no one way to handle things. I just didn't feel for it anymore. I wasn't interested in the characters. I wasn't interested in anything to do with them, really. I just didn't think it was worth my time. And so I said it to the agents and I said it to the publishing house. I said, look, this is not going to work. And they were really wonderful. They were very understanding and it was just a thing. And then one night I was in the sitting room and I was at my computer and I wrote the scene where Elliot's trying to get dressed, which when people read the book, it's at the very start of the book. And he's trying to get dressed and he's very badly injured, but he won't for some reason, even when he's on his own, he won't do things any other way other than how Elliot would do it. So when he gets out of the shower, he walks to his bathroom upright, but he won't use a wall to give himself any balance because that's not what he would do. So he gets dressed and I finished that chapter and I sent it to my daughter who lives in Barcelona and I said, who is this? And she just started to laugh and she said, that's granddad. He's a much younger man, obviously, in the book, but that's granddad.
Right, so your father-in-law.
My father-in-law had two ways of doing things. He either did it Terry's way or it was wrong. And that's the sort of man he was. And it just stuck at me that Elliot will be like this. Elliot will be exactly like this. You'll either do it Elliot's way or you're going to do it the wrong way. And this is what Nola has to contend with when she, you know, and she gets tied in with him as well, because there is no other way to do it except the fossil's way, or in this case, Elliot's way.
What was your family's reaction to him being inspired by your father-in-law, your key detective?
I didn't say a whole lot about it at the time until I gave it to my husband to read. And then, you know, there are certain moments in the book where it's, you know, it obviously Elliot is a, you know, he's a fictional character. But everything that's good and decent about him, everything that's honest and forthright and that makes him this stalwart lion of a man is very Terry. You know, Terry was all of those things. And he did it with style and he did it with panache and he did it because he loved his family and he was just that kind of guy. And he came from a different era from what, you know, he was different. He was 1938 or 36 when he was born. So he was a very different man. And so I liked that about Elliot a lot. I liked everything. Even to how he treats his daughter, you know, with Shona, he doesn't really understand it, but his love for her is unquestionable.
Now, you don't have to tell us who the inspiration for these people are, but there's a group of ex-pupils from a rather posh Dublin school. So that must have been fun to write about. Do you know that milieu?
I've met that milieu a few times and they're fascinating. It's a bit like going to see like wild animals in a documentary. They're a breed apart. If you have ever met the very, very rich, they don't live in this world. They don't live in our world. Everything is completely different. Their loyalties are different. Their view of loyalty is different. Their view of the little person is different. Their view of employment is different. Their view of owning a house is different. The idea that you might own two or three houses, which ironically this week has been a bit of an eye-opener for plenty of people. So it was really interesting to write this group because their loyalties are to themselves first and foremost. And Jodie would have been a connector to them, but at the same time, what happened to her, they don't want to break rank. And I understand that kind of thing, that kind of weird loyalty, this tie-in. And even when they're the most reprehensible people you'll ever meet, they still hold rank because that's who they are. They are the elite. And it was very interesting to write, you know, to write these people because they're just sort of morally bankrupt, genuinely morally bankrupt. And Nola at one point says, you know, to Elliot, like, you know, if a kid, because there's like from the school that these people go to, she said, if a kid in our area was caught with a bag of weed, you know, they'd be up in the courts before his feet would touch the ground. He said, these people operate in a completely different, a whole stratum that's completely different. And they get away with everything because there's money behind them. And because their fathers and their mothers can afford the greatest lawyers, they don't even see court. It's sorted out. Everything's sorted. So the idea that you somehow have to face consequences does not exist in this world, and they're fun to write.
Right, I bet they are. And dogs?
Oh, dogs, yeah, of course. There's loads of dogs in this. It's great. I am the owner of two German Shepherds. Everyone in the world seems to know it because I'm always blathering on about them. But in this book, Jodie has taken on a protection dog at the start of the book, Athos. He's a super Belgian Malinois protection. But on the night that she was attacked, for whatever reason, she had put him outside and he couldn't get in. And so he could not save her. He could not protect her. But, you know, he's a major part. And also, he's a brilliant dog. Who could not like a good Belgian Malinois?
Well, the book is called While She Sleeps from Arlene Hunt. And it's published by Hachette. Arlene Hunt, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up to 12 minutes to 8. There are hotels in Japan that provide special crying rooms for people, mostly women, to escape life stresses. You check in, watch tearjerker movies, or listen to sad music and cry. These hotels were the inspiration for a new show from Chaos Factory Theatre Company that premieres at the Project Arts Centre next month. It's called Hotel Happiness. The director, Luke Casserly, joins me now. Luke. Tell me about the Hotel Happiness or their origin in these crying rooms in the Japanese format.
Yes. So as you said, the inspiration for the play is these hotels that began to emerge around 2014, 2015 in Japan, where people could go to spend time in a customized hotel room as a way of sort of unleashing their emotions or feelings of sadness. And I suppose it was kind of a commentary, an interesting commentary on a kind of sick society where it was socially unacceptable to be emotional or vulnerable in some way. And so that's where the idea for the play originally came from. And so it's based on that. And the hotel that we're in the play, is a place that has a certain kind of set of rules in terms of how you can go there. So you can apply to go and then you get a text message to tell you that you've been successful in your application. And then you go there and then you get assigned to a certain room and you go to spend the time alone, which is quite important. But the twist in the play is that the two characters that we meet, Nina and Celeste, end up in the room together. By design, by the hotel.
Okay, so that's, by design, by the hotel.
The hotel has intervened to put them together.
Oh, right. Okay, well, let's listen to a clip from your production, from the rehearsal. The women have just met and are getting to know each other. Celeste asks Nina questions, trying to find out why she has come to the hotel. Celeste is played by Venetia Beaux and Fionnuala Gygax is Nina.
Are you with someone now?
I was.
And what happened?
I came here.
Well, this is hardly a life sentence. We're only here for 24 hours. Do they know you're here?
No. I just left.
No goodbye?
No. I didn't say anything. Didn't take any of my things. I didn't leave him a note or a text. I just walked out.
Did something happen?
Not really. That's the worst part. I don't even have a dramatic abuse story to justify it or for you to give me sympathy about.
But you wanted to leave.
I had to leave. And I'm not going back.
So you don't love him? Is that it?
That doesn't even come into it. Do you trust me?
I'm not sure. I keep changing my mind about that.
Why? Can't quite work me out?
Not fully.
Your scientist brain must be feeling like a bit of a failure.
No. Some things take time. I know that.
I'm not some experiment. You shouldn't trust me, just so you know.
Why is that?
Because a lot of things I say are lies. I lie all the time.
About?
Loads of things.
I don't think you've told me enough about yourself for me to assume you've been lying. Your partner, was he a lie?
No, that was true.
Are you a composer?
Yeah.
So what's a lie? Are you secretly an extremely happy social butterfly with an incredibly supportive family and a great job that you love, and you're just playing the role of the defensive lone wolf woman in here for kicks?
No.
God, Celeste is giving Nina a hard time, isn't she? Celeste is played by Venetia Beaux and Fionnuala Gygax is playing Nina. And they are the writers, Fionnuala and Venetia.
That's right, exactly. So Venetia Beaux and Fionnuala Gygax, along with Rachel Bergen, are the are Chaos Factory.
Right,
yes.
Okay. And they did they write the play or is it an improvised piece?
No, so Venetia and Fionnuala are the playwrights.
Okay.
And also the performers of the work.
Okay, so so we heard there, I think, that that Nina is a composer.
Yes, exactly.
So how much can you tell us about each of the characters?
Yeah, so the characters are, I suppose the play, okay, is kind of like, it's set in this hotel room, but really what we're leaning on in the production is the transformative power of connection between the two women who have this chance encounter that ends up being very intense, you know. So Nina, as you mentioned, is a composer and she's dealing with the sort of regret of making a decision that has now changed her life. So she's sort of exploring this idea of creating or carving out a space to create a new persona for herself. And she's sort of asking herself the question, how do I start again, or how do I shed a new skin and start over in her own life? And then Celeste is a scientist, and she works specifically in genetics. And she is sort of in the throes of grief at the moment, having lost somebody very close to her recently. And so she's trying very, very desperately to conjure that person, or to sort of bring them back in a sort of... in a way, as a way of sort of coping with that grief. So they're both going through very different human experiences.
And they probably think that the last thing they want is to be sharing this room they thought they were able to meditate on their own grief.
Exactly. And the play is really like a meditation on grief and sort of motherhood. And yes, exactly. They kind of come in expecting to spend time alone for 24 hours, but of course that's not the case. And in actual fact, both of the characters needed to meet the other one at this particular point in time in their life
but
in
they
order
just
to
don't
progress.
Know that yet.
Exactly.
Okay, and why can't they leave the hotel?
Well, so the idea is that you spend time in isolation alone. So that's sort of the premise of this hotel, so that they're forced to spend time to kind of figure things out, alone. So they can't leave because they kind of enter into a pact to spend the 24 hours there, for better or for worse.
So you as the director then and the production team have
yes.
to build a space
yes,
that
exactly.
makes the audience believe, you know, that this is, you know, a kind of strange space, maybe an unnatural space. I'm not sure.
Yes. So I suppose, yeah, we're kind of influenced by this, you know, this phenomenon of a capitalist sort of wellness industry. So that's definitely informing the kind of production in a way. So for the play, just to give context, we're in an interior hotel space, but the production, I suppose, is taking a fairly abstract approach to how that space is translated into a theatre environment. So there's certainly suggestions of a hotel room architecture, but we move quite fluidly between different moments within the 24-hour time frame in the space. And so for all of that, I suppose the hotel is a kind of transient atmospheric place where different scenarios and instances can occur between the characters. So, you know, it's kind of, you know, they talk about a range of different things, from relationships to family, to grief, to loneliness, to their bodies. And really, I suppose the production is and the space that they exist in is a kind of place where all of those things can be talked about and where different things can occur.
So if it's a pretty abstract space, does that mean lighting and sound will play a big role in it?
Definitely. And we have a really brilliant team. So we have the production features original composition by Dennis Clohessy, and lighting design by Dara Hoban, and then stage design by Clara Cohen. So we're sort of working very collaboratively. And as you mentioned, Venetia and Fanula are the writers of the piece and also the performers, and I'm directing it. But we're working very collaboratively as a sort of whole team to bring the whole thing to life.
So as a director, do you ever say, maybe you change that line, or could we discuss Act 3 or something? Or are they very sensitive conversations?
Time does not exist in this play. But it's certainly very collaborative. Like the text is written by Venetia and Fanula, but we've certainly been editing in rehearsals and devising certain moments as well. So it's very fluid and very sort of organic in terms of how we work together.
Yeah, I suppose you make one think of Beckett, obviously, or perhaps something more sci-fi, something like Space Odyssey or something.
Yeah, I think audiences coming to see the show will certainly have those associations with Beckett because of the sort of the liminal space and two characters, you know, placed in a space where time moves in a non-linear way, or in a sort of strange, slowed down way in different moments. So there will be those associations, I think. But in terms of the sci-fi thing, that might be an association as well. But we're certainly not leaning on that in the production.
Right. And is there a lockdown element to it? Maybe did they write it during lockdown, this idea of, you know, people being isolated or maybe having to make do with the person you're with.
Yeah, no, I don't believe the project was conceived during lockdown specifically. But again, I think because that time is so close to us, you know, in society, I think audiences coming to see the work will also have that association, having just spent so much time in isolation and separated from people. And also there's sort of like a, there is a loneliness pandemic, I think, worldwide, you know, so there will be sort of that reading of it as well. But I think the kind of original investigation into this was looking at the hotel as a space and how that actually impacts one's behavior, and also how one kind of one's body and sort of voice exists in a space, how a space can become performative. So the hotel space was really the starting point for this production and for the play.
Well, Hotel Happiness from Chaos Factory Theatre Company runs at the Project Arts Centre from the 11th to the 17th of September as part of the Dublin Fringe Festival. Check out fringefest.com for more details. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Liam Murphy and Paula Shields. Mark McGraw was on sound. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator, and Fionn O'Brien is on after the news at 8.